Well, we have reached the, oops. Forgot my Bible. Oh, here it is. We've reached the 9th chapter of Revelation. And if you may remember, we left off last week on a rather ominous note at the end of the 8th chapter. We had just been through the first four of the trumpets. And at verse 13 of the 8th chapter, we read this: "As I watched, I heard an eagle that was flying in midair call out in a loud voice, 'Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the trumpet blast about to be sounded by the other three angels.'" We have the fifth, sixth, and the seventh angels yet to blow their trumpets. Well, I thought the first four were pretty bad. The first four dealt with disasters, natural disasters that would come upon the earth and different aspects of the earth. The trees and the green grass, the sea, the fresh waters, and the sun, the moon, and the stars in the heavens. Sort of a reversal, as someone said in Sunday school, of the days of creation, where these things were created in turn. Now they're being affected in turn by these disasters. And the one thing we noticed was that whenever the angel did something in heaven, something corresponding would happen on the earth. And we see that all through Revelation, the interplay between the supernatural and the natural world. And we're going to see that again today. But it sort of left me holding my breath last week when I read those words, thinking, so this is bad, but what's coming is even worse. And today we have the first of what are called the three woes. The fifth angel blows the trumpet, and corresponding things happen on the earth. So we're going to read that here. Yes, we're going to read the first 12 verses of the 9th chapter, not all the way through, because the last half of the 9th chapter begins the sixth angel's trumpet, and we don't want to get into that today. "The fifth angel sounded his trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. When he opened the abyss, smoke rose from it like the smoke from a gigantic furnace. The sun and sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss, and out of the smoke locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of the scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were not given the power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. And the agony they suffered was like that of the sting of a scorpion when it strikes a man. During those days, men will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. The locusts looked like horses prepared for battle. On their heads they wore something like crowns of gold. Their faces resembled human faces. Their hair was like women's hair. Their teeth were like lion's teeth. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. They had tails and stings like scorpions, and in their tails they had the power to torment people for 5 months. They had as king over them the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek, Apollyon. The first woe was past. Two other woes are yet to come." Wow. Talk about dreams. That sounds like a nightmare. I don't usually have dreams like that unless I really eat something I shouldn't eat, but John is seeing all of this right before his eyes. He's not sleeping. It's not a dream. It's a vision that God has given to him of what is to come. Let's take a look, make our way through it briefly, and then I have a few things I'd like to say about it. First thing I'd like to say is how different the Bible in general is from our own ideas of God and of the supernatural realm. It strikes me right off the bat when it says the fifth angel sounded his trumpet. Because, you know, we've been seeing a lot of angels lately with the Christmas story and the Christmas season upon us. And every angel I see in modern culture is female, with wings and all. But these angels are not. They're men, and they're not delightful creatures who we all hope we can someday meet and have for tea, maybe. These angels are rather awesome, and we don't really think of them as servants of mankind, which is what the Bible says the angels are. These angels are definitely serving God, but they're not doing most of mankind any favors. It sort of makes us realize that the whole issue of the supernatural is more serious than our culture tends to make it. And it'd be good for us to keep that in mind. When the angel sounds his trumpet, and in case you're wondering, many people think the word for trumpet here is the same as the Hebrew word shofar. If you've ever seen the curled ram's horn that the priests would blow, that's a shofar. And it has special significance in the Old Testament. And that's the trumpet that is sounding here. I have one. I was going to bring it this morning. But then I remember the last time I brought it. That was back when I was still doing children's sermons. I had just gotten it as a gift. And I was showing it to the kids. And I was having a hard time blowing it because I'm just not a musician. And I handed it to Lauren Ballyett, and I forgot she plays the trumpet. She put that up to her lips, and just like nothing, she blew a blast on it, and I thought, I'm never showing this to anybody again. But anyway, he blew his trumpet, and then something happened, as with all of the other trumpets. The trumpet blows, and something happens on the earth that affects the earth or the people dwelling there. And what he sees, he says, is a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. Now, the imagery of the star is often used in the Bible to designate an angel, because the angels are considered celestial beings, and the stars, of course, are celestial objects in the sky. In the Old Testament, the sky, not the atmosphere, but the outer space, is often used for imagery involving the supernatural. Because it's there, it's real, but it's so far different from what we are involved in. We can't touch it. We can only see it. We don't know much about it. It's very mysterious, and this all fits in very well with the imagery of the supernatural. He saw a star that had fallen to the earth. Now, that word fallen, we hear that, especially in relation to the star. We think of the star as an angel, which it turns out the star is an angel. We hear the words fallen and angel together, and immediately we think of Satan, the fallen angel. However, the word fallen here does not mean morally fallen. It simply means direction-wise. The star, the angel, you might say, has come from heaven to earth. He doesn't see it fall. He sees it there, which is to say, he sees an angel who's supposed to be dwelling in heaven and instead is doing something on the earth. And so he describes it using the word fallen. He had fallen from the heaven to the earth. Later in chapter 20, we're going to see another fellow in the same place as this angel. Chapter 20, verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss and holding a great chain. And at that point, he's going to take Satan and he's going to chain him up and put him in the abyss. So this angel is not Satan. And chances are pretty good, I would say, this angel is not a, quote, fallen angel. It's not one of the demons, because he comes from heaven with a job to do. He's been given a job to do from God. That is, he's been given the key to the abyss. And he unlocks the abyss, and what's in it comes out. And what's in it are demons. And now we know why a lot of people don't like the book of Revelation. They don't like talk about demons. They certainly don't like talk about judgment, because God's supposed to be a God of love. There's not a single thing in this opening part of chapter 9 that I would say most people reading it would be glad to hear. They would look at it and they would either think it's too fantastic or it's too violent for God to be involved in any way. Well, we'll deal with that in a moment, but for now, I want to tell you a little bit more about the abyss, just so you know what it is. The word abyss is a Greek word. It's just taken out of the Greek and put into English, because we don't really have another word for it. And the word means a place that has no bottom. The bottomless pit, it's sometimes referred to. And you may remember on one occasion when Jesus was casting a demon out of somebody, the demon spoke to him and said, "I know who you are. You're the Holy Son of God. What are you doing here? It's not time for me to be sent to the abyss." It's one of those things that's sort of like the demon speaks and Jesus is like, "Darn, I shouldn't have let him get that out of his lips." You know, he's not supposed to talk like that. There are things that human beings are not supposed to hear. We'll see later in Revelation. John hears thunder, and he says, "The thunder spoke, and I was going to write down what the thunder spoke, and an angel said to me, 'Don't write that down. Don't tell anybody.'" You may remember Paul in his letter to the Corinthians said, "I remember there was this man about 14 years ago, he had a vision of heaven. He was taken to the third heaven, and he heard things that it's not lawful for man to speak." Wow. I just go about my everyday life doing the usual things, get up in the morning, have breakfast, to work in the office a little bit, go out and visit. And Paul's talking about going places where they say things you're not allowed to talk about. Puts me in mind of these fiscal cliff talks they had behind the scenes in this most transparent administration that we've ever had in our country. And the senators come out and the congressmen come out and they say, "Well, I can't tell you what we talked about, but..." And then they have these talks on Benghazi and what happened in Libya, and they come out of the talks and they say, "Well, I can't tell you what we talked about, but..." And then the papers say, "Unnamed sources have indicated saying things that nobody's really supposed to talk about, but there it is." Well, even in heaven there are things that are not supposed to be talked about. But every now and then we get a glimpse, just a little glimmer, of a whole aspect of creation that is beyond our awareness. And today is one of those days, and we can't really deal with this trumpet blast unless we talk a little bit about it. What is the abyss? The abyss is a place set aside as a prison for the angels who have fallen with Satan, who have rebelled against God, who have taken their rebellion to the point where they need to be confined. There's actually a prison for spirits who are rebellious. Just as there are prisons, we have so many of them around us, I really think that Union County has a higher prison population in relation to the rest of the population in any place in the country. So we have the camp and the prison in Lewisburg, and we have the camp and the three different prisons up in Allenwood. So plus we've got our own county prison. So we're very familiar with prisons. And the abyss is a prison. It's a place the spirits go to when they've gone overboard, when they've gone beyond the limits God has set for them. And we could get into a discussion of why does God even allow the angels to go as far as they do? Why does he allow Satan to do the things he does? Every now and then you'll read in the Bible where God gives permission to Satan to do things, but there are always limits on it, like there were with Job. Go so far, but no further. Well, sometimes the angels who have rebelled overstep those limits, and then they are put in the abyss. And it is a prison, and they are in prison there until the time for their release. And the time for their release has come. And the angel releases them, and the release of these demons looks to John like the eruption of a cloud coming out of this pit. It's as if somebody takes a cork out of a teapot, maybe, or something that's boiling on the stove, and you take the top off of it, and the steam comes out, pours out up into the, and of course it rises up to the ceiling because that's what steam does. And this cloud does the same thing. He sees it. He's seeing things that we cannot see. Even if we were with him, unless God gave us the vision, we would not see it. It's something that does not register on the scale of visible light that human beings are able to see. But John is given the ability to see it, and it looks to him like a cloud. And notice the language he uses. He used words like. It's like a cloud, and the things that come out of it are like locusts, and they look like this, and they have faces like a man. That's to remind us that he's only giving us comparisons. He's not saying they have a man's face. He's not saying they're horses. He's saying this is what they look like. And they're told not to harm the grass of the earth. The grass has already had judgment against it. Not because of anything it has done, but because of the sin of Adam. And this is another thing Revelation reminds us of. Many people are grateful that Jesus came and died on the cross, and they say he died on the cross because he loves humanity. Well, that's true. He does. He loves humanity, but he also loves the Father, and it's the Father who told him to do this, and he's being obedient. And there's one other thing he loves. In John chapter 3, verse 16, we are told that God so loved the world. Not just that God loved people, but he loved the world. He loved his creation. And the thing we often forget is that when Adam fell, he took creation with him. It's not just that we fell with Adam and that we are sinners because he sinned, but when he sinned, all of creation was affected. This is why I just cannot accept in my mind that death existed in this universe before the fall of Adam. Because Paul tells us in Romans that the only reason there is death and decay in this universe is because of Adam's sin. When he sinned, all of creation was affected because he was the crowning achievement of creation. And when the top of creation is affected, that just filters down into every aspect of creation. Now there's not a part of creation that's not affected by decay and death. And Paul tells us that creation is waiting and groaning for the day when all that curse will be reversed and when God will restore creation to its perfection. And with the coming of the first four trumpets, we had judgment on nature, on the natural world. But now we're moving beyond the natural world, and we're doing things that are affecting human beings specifically. And so they are told, again we see them given limits, showing that God is sovereign even over evil. He says, don't touch the grass or any plant or any tree, but only those who do not have the seal of God on their forehead. Remember, a couple chapters ago, God sent the angel out to seal all those who are God's people, put a seal on their forehead. We think most people, when they hear Revelation and they hear the word seal on the forehead, they think of the Antichrist. As if he thought of the idea. And the number 666 on the forehead or on the right hand. Satan has no original idea in his brain. There's not an original bone in his body. Everything Satan does is simply a corruption and a counterfeit of what God has already done. And the seal that will be put on the forehead or on the right hand of those who follow the Antichrist, it's just a counterfeit of a seal that already exists on the forehead of those who belong to God. We are marked by God. Have you ever seen in some churches that have high liturgies like the Catholic Church and the New Catholic, I'm sorry, the Lutheran Church, the ELCA? I was to one a few weeks ago, complete with sprinkling water and everything. On Ash Wednesday, or when a person's baptized, what does the priest do? He takes his finger and he makes a mark like this, a mark of the cross on the forehead. Why? Because of that verse a few chapters ago that says that God marks those who are his. And there are passages throughout the Bible that tell us that we are sealed and we are chosen by God from before we were born. Even Paul, before he was converted, bore the seal of God because he was a marked man. God had chosen him for a certain work. Didn't matter that he hated God, that he hated Christ. When the time came, God took him and he said, "You're mine. I have chosen you." And what could Paul say? I've heard atheists who say, "Yeah, let God come talk to me. We'll sit down and chat for a while." Ha ha. I'd like to see any of them come up with any words to say if God sat down and talked to them. And so it was with Paul. What could he say? Is he going to sit there next to the living God who appeared to him in a vision so brilliant it outshone the sun in the desert at noon, and he's going to say to the person in this vision, "I don't believe you exist." And Jesus would just laugh at him. Probably grab him by the robe and say, "Do you think I exist now? You're mine. I've chosen you." And so God has marked out all those who are his, and not one of them will be lost. What a tremendous promise that is. And here at the end of this age, we see an especially important aspect of what a blessing this is. Because when judgment comes, just as in the book of Exodus, when God sent plagues on Egypt, there came a point in the progression of plagues when God said, "I make a distinction between my people and the people of Egypt. And there will be plagues that come that will affect the people of Egypt. My people will not be touched." And then the greatest plague of all, the death of the firstborn, in which Jesus gave to all people without exception the opportunity, if you want to save yourself, just sacrifice a lamb, put the blood over the doorpost, on the doorpost and over the lintel of the door. Stay in the house, and when the angel comes, he'll pass over your house. And that's when the choosing of God really demonstrated itself, because those whom he had called did exactly what he had said. And they were protected. God does not do a general judgment without remembering his people. I think that's what my dream was about last night. For those times when I'm totally out of control, when circumstances are coming that I know are going to affect me adversely, as I look at my country and I see it throwing its heritage away. I read in the paper this morning a couple of items, both having to do with the family. And both talking about how we don't have families anymore. Particularly, we don't have fathers because we're not teaching our boys to be men. We're teaching our boys to be women. And so even in families where they have a father and a mother, they really have two mothers. They don't have a father because nobody's being the man in the house. And this is the choice our country has made, and we are going to experience the consequences of that choice. The last election, we made a choice, and we are going to experience the consequences of that choice. I didn't choose that way, but I'm living in the country that did. And I will go through the consequences that those choices are going to result in. What a blessing to know that God is a personal God, and in the midst of judgment, he remembers his people. And he promises that all who call upon the name of the Lord will be saved. There is protection available for those who will surrender their lives to God and follow Jesus Christ. This is, to me, the most precious part of this whole passage. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their forehead. And they're not given the power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. The torture will be so intense they'll want to die and won't be able to. They will seek death, and death will elude them for 5 months. Then he goes on to describe. Well, I suppose there are a lot of people, maybe there are some people who are following these sermons online or who are getting CDs, maybe some of you who come here week after week, and you've put up with me for 8 weeks, for 8 chapters. But in the back of your mind, you're thinking, I really don't like the book of Revelation. And sooner or later, I'm not going to want to go any further. And maybe for some of you, this week we reach that point. I know for a lot of people, chapter 9 is a turning point. They finally had enough of God's judgment, they want God's love. Why wouldn't they? It's like someone I know who has chosen a way that is contrary to the way of God, and her favorite Bible verse is, judge not that you not be judged. What a surprise. Nothing about the sufficiency of God, nothing about obedience to God, just don't judge me. And if anything defines our culture at this point in history, that's it. Don't judge me. And God is judging in this book. This whole book is about judgment, among other things. They finally get to this chapter and they said, no, enough. No wonder the angel said, whoa, 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 for the three angels that are yet to blow their trumpets. And at the end of this passage, we read the first woe is past. There are two more to come. A lot of people say, not for me, there's not. I quit right here. There's at least three reasons why people decide at this point that they don't want to go any further in Revelation. First of all, the imagery is just too fantastic. I mean, what are we supposed to make of angels, of demons, that look like locusts, have a sting in their tail, whose heads are like the heads of men, but they look like horses prepared for battle. They have breastplates like breastplates of iron. What kind of locust is he looking at? This guy is high on something. And my answer to that is, what's the matter? Do you think such a creature doesn't exist? Well, of course it doesn't exist. It's too fanciful. Well, let me tell you something. I remember the first time when our kids were struggling with allergies. I remember the first time a doctor handed us a pamphlet on dust mites. Have you ever seen a dust mite? Now, these are things that exist by the billions, if not the trillions, in our world. If I go home to my house, I bet hundreds of thousands of dust mites occupy my house. It could be the neatest house in the county, and there's still going to be hundreds of thousands of dust mites in my house. Do you know what a dust mite looks like? It's one of the ugliest creatures God ever invented. And what would you do if you saw a magnification of a dust mite and someone asked you, now describe to me what that thing looks like? Okay. Dust mites don't look like locusts. But since then, I have seen other microscopic creatures that don't look too far off. Our congregation has been affected by the flu. The flu virus doesn't look too pleasant either. In fact, Megan came across a place where you can order stuffed animals in the shape of microscopic creatures. She's got a red blood cell. Looks like a red donut. She's got a lactobacillus. Any of you ever take acidophilus for digestion? It just looks like a cylinder, a purple cylinder with eyes on it. They all have eyes on it. The cold virus looks like a soccer ball with two big black eyes on it. Well, they've got stuffed animals for white blood cells. Those look really strange. For nerve cells, for flu virus, for anything you can imagine. Because these things look like something. Not like anything I've ever seen before, but they look like something. And how would you describe it if you had to? To my way of thinking, these demons impacted human beings the way disease does, the way germs do. This is how they manifest themselves. How else would you describe something that causes a person to experience this kind of physical agony? You know, there are organisms that can cause a person to feel so sick they want to die. Well, with me, it's the cold virus, because I'm a wimp when it comes to sickness. When I get a stuffy nose, when I get a headache, I just want to die. Of course, I'm speaking figuratively. But I have known people so sick that they have told God over and over again, I'm ready. Just take me. I have heard of people who have suffered from bone cancer, which they tell me is one of the more painful cancers. It's agony. And so the idea of something that causes physical distress for a distinct period of time, 5 months or whatever it might be, that's not too hard for me to believe. To describe the organism that causes that disease, I think he does a pretty good job. Now, we think just because he's describing angels, they should have wings. And if they're fallen angels, instead of white robes, maybe they're just dirty robes. But we've already seen in heaven angels that don't look like the angels we're used to seeing. What about the four living creatures that surround the throne? What about the cherubim and the seraphim that flew around the temple when Isaiah was called to his ministry? They didn't look like any angels I've seen portrayed in Christmas cards. For one thing, they had six wings, not two. So what's so incredible about it? I mean, we're talking about supernatural beings. That makes it incredible enough. But I don't really see any reason why this description has to take us in the 20th century by surprise. If there are any people throughout time who should be equipped to believe such a description, it should be us. Because we've seen things like this. I have. Magnifications of microscopic creatures. Creatures that 200 years ago the medical community laughed at. Germs? There's no such thing as a germ. Did you know that? Just as recently as maybe 200 years ago, the scientific community did not believe that germs caused disease. Why? Because most people had never seen one. And they could not believe that something that tiny could cause such distress in otherwise healthy people. Now today we have commercials of mucus. See that guy in the mucus commercial? Looks sort of like my next door neighbor. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't really. Don't tell my neighbor I said that. But that gives you an idea. We're talking about real things that really exist, and they have a description. And how else are you going to describe them? Well, people will say, demons just don't exist. And the abyss is a myth. And then I remind them, well, you know, they said the same thing about germs not too long ago. Why do you say it doesn't exist? Just because you've never been there? Well, let me tell you, if you go to the AAA and tell them that you want to go somewhere on a holiday, they're not going to book you for a trip to the abyss. It's not the sort of place that people see on a regular basis. Does that mean it doesn't exist? I've heard people talk about Machu Picchu. I just mentioned that because I like to say the name, Machu Picchu. It's in Peru. And it's ancient ruins of an ancient civilization. Well, what if I decide I don't want to believe that the Incas or the Mayans or the Aztecs ever existed? I've never seen one. I've never been to their ruins. Yeah, I've seen pictures, just like I read this description. I've never been there. Nobody in his right mind would deny that such places exist. Why is it so hard for us in the Western world to imagine that the spiritual realm exists? Because we've worked so hard to get rid of it. Starting with evolution, we have worked so hard to prove to ourselves we don't need a God to explain this world. We don't need God to explain creation, we have evolution. We don't need God to explain emotional distress, we have psychology. We don't need God to help us with disease because we've got the medical community. And gradually, just like our government is doing, gradually we push God into a little corner of our lives where we go to worship on Sunday morning, and the rest of the week we can forget about. And now God bursts on the scene with this description that the only way we can accept that it is real is to accept that there is a whole dimension that surrounds us on a daily basis that we're totally unaware of. And most people just do not want to admit that they are that ignorant of anything. But that's an awfully weak excuse for rejecting it. I think the real objection people have to this passage and to Revelation in general is they just do not believe that God is the sort of God that this book presents. I encounter this every time there's a natural disaster. And people talk about why. Now you know we don't even need God to explain natural disasters because we have global warming. And you can talk about global warming as much as you want. And if that doesn't satisfy, you can talk about Mother Nature as much as you want. But you begin to suggest that God is behind some of these natural disasters. Oh, no, no, no. God's not like that. God would never cause disaster. He's a God of love. Do you know that in Isaiah's book of prophecy, over and over again, Isaiah says specifically, speaking for God, I bring prosperity and I bring disaster. I, the Lord, am God of both. A God who only brings blessing and is helpless in the face of disaster is no God. The very word God implies power and sovereignty over everything. And if he is sovereign over everything, then everything is under his control and responsibility. Does that mean God has to give us an excuse for why disasters happen? No, because that assumes that the disaster is a mistake. And furthermore, God does not have to justify himself to anyone. But there are many times when he does. He uses natural disasters to draw people to him. Now the world has decided we don't need to worry about God when it comes to natural disasters. For one thing, he didn't cause it. For another thing, he has no control over it. And for another thing, we can handle our own lives without you. Thank you. And that's really what we want to say to God. I don't need you. Come for me when I'm dead. But until then, leave me alone. Did you know that in the book of Job, that's exactly the way Job describes the wicked? The wicked prosper in everything they do, Job says. Their cattle never miscarry. The sheep always have one or sometimes two offspring. They're always healthy. They grow to full life. They've got good wool on them. They make a lot of money with them. And what marks these people as evil? In the midst of their prosperity, they say to God, "Leave me alone. I don't need you. I don't want you. Leave me alone." That's what makes them evil. It's not that they cheat their neighbor. It's not that they steal other people's property. It's that when it comes to God, they somehow think that all their prosperity God had nothing to do with. And they decide, "I'm doing just fine all by myself." And if there's any chapter in the Bible that describes American culture as we hit the year 2013, that is it. Leave me alone, God. And when you do enter my life, you better be nice or I'll kick you out. And this chapter does not present God as nice. It presents God as sovereign, as all-powerful, acting on behalf of his people, but bringing judgment. And that does not fit the modern template of what God is supposed to be like. The only way we'll accept God is if God is a good God who loves and forgives everybody, has unconditional love to the extent you can do whatever you want, even after choosing to believe in him. You can do anything you want. And you're his, and he'll save you, and you won't go to hell, and if there is a heaven, you'll go there, but we really don't think there is one anyway, so it doesn't matter. No, the reason we don't like Revelation is because it confronts us where we live. Far from being fantastic and unimaginable, the words and the message of Revelation are loud and clear. Only in God is there safety. Only in God is there true life. Only by following God, that means obedience, do we have hope. With this in mind, I'd like to close my message this morning by having you join me in a responsive reading that appears on the back of the bulletin if you turn to the back of the bulletin. This is a collection of verses in the Bible that I thought all had something to do with today's message, and I knew I wouldn't have time to deal with all of them, and so I thought, well, I'll just put them in a reading and we'll all read them together. So I'll read the regular print, and I ask you to read the bold print. And then if you have the time and would like to stay for Sunday school, I tell you, there is a particular passage in Ezekiel that I would like to compare to today's reading of the fifth trumpet. I don't have time during the sermon, but we will talk about it during Sunday school, so I hope to see you there. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They will be filled. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. God's solid foundation stands firm, sealed with this inscription. Turn from evil and do good, then you will dwell in the land forever. They will be protected forever, but the offspring of the wicked will be cut off. Someone asked Jesus, Lord, are only a few people going to be saved?
He said to them, "Many of you have received
Then you will say, we ate and drank with you, and you taught in our streets. Whoever thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have made yourself known to us. We thank you that you have given us the courage to address our lives and through your Spirit to identify those evil influences and activities and attitudes that keep us from experiencing your blessings. We pray as the time draws nearer for your Son's return that we might be about the work of preparing ourselves for his coming, so that if he were to come today, we would be ready. Over and over again, he told his disciples, be ready then, because you do not know the day or the hour. So help us to live as those who truly do believe in you, and not as those who only come to you when there's trouble. And when things are going well, think they can handle life on their own. Thank you for your patience, for your love, for your forgiveness. Thank you for calling us into the fellowship of your Son, Jesus Christ, in whom we pray. Amen.